Truth Seekers.
Good evening.
Welcome to tonight's program. My name is Mike Malloy. Thanks for tuning in wherever you are. Listen, there's only going to be one happy part of the program tonight, and that's going to be read. Well, maybe third hour. We finally got some good news from the Obama administration, but I'm going to let that wait until the third hour. But I need to tell you, I just do. If you are, if you're looking for what we usually do on this program, which is joy and laughter and uplifting commentaries, tonight is not going to be one of those nights, I'm afraid. So let me bookend the program. I've got a bit of good news here at the beginning, and I'll have a bit of good news in the third hour. Here's the bit of good news in the beginning. Do any of you know, ever heard of David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S, David Rovics? Have you heard of him? He's a musician. He is a, in a more gentle age, I guess we would have called him a folk singer. His songs remind me, in not a small way, of early Bob Dylan. Some of the lyrics that were sung by Peter, Paul, and Mary, which were written by Bob Dylan, a lot of those songs. But David Rovics is, I got to tell you just a little bit, and then I'm going to move on. I want you to go to his website, davidrovics.com. It's David, R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovics.com. And the reason there is a reason I'm telling you this, all right? Anyway, he grew up in a family of classical musicians in Connecticut. And in the early 90s, he was a full-time busker, street performer in the Boston subways. And by the mid-90s, he was traveling the world as a professional flat-picking rabble-rouser. Now, these days, David lives with his family in Portland, Oregon, home of KPOJ that carries this program. And he tours regularly on four different continents. He plays for audiences large and small at cafes, pubs, universities, churches, union halls, protest rallies. He has shared the stage with the veritable who's who of the left in two dozen countries. And you can read some of David's stuff. His essays are published regularly on Counterpunch. And he has 200-plus songs that he makes available for free on the web that have been downloaded more than a million times. A million times. And more importantly, he's really good. He'll make you laugh, he'll make you cry, and he'll make the revolution irresistible. Now, the reason I'm telling you, several months back, I made some remark about, you know, who's doing protest music these days, like back in the 60s and 50s, late 50s and into the 60s. And it never occurred to me, David, whom I've met, I think I met him, where did I meet him, in Phoenix? Was it in Phoenix back when, during the Nova M days? Or was it in New York during the Air America days? Or I don't know. But I've met David. Maybe it was in Madison, Wisconsin. I don't know. But I have met him before, and I've listened to his music. We don't play enough of it on this program. But the reason I bring up his name is simply that there has got to be. And I hope you understand what I'm saying here. There's got to be a soundtrack to a movement. There has to be something that is outside my head, your head, that you can link to, where it concerns trying to resist, however you want to resist, what is happening in this country. Now, the soundtrack of the 40s, especially the early 40s, was swing music. The soundtrack of the 50s was, oh, never mind, don't go there. The soundtrack of the 60s, you know what it was. You can hear a song, if you're of a certain age, you can hear a song, bang. That was the soundtrack from the 60s. 70s, yeah, it's still there. 80s, even, yeah, a lot of people say, 80s, there's no music in the 80s. Yes, there was. And so on and so on. David Rovics, we're 10 years into this sad new century, But David Rovick's music is, for more and more people, is becoming the soundtrack of the protest or the what the hell are we going to do kind of, and not in a negative way, but, you know, what in the hell are we going to do? Well, we're going to do this kind of background. Please do me a favor. I'm not getting paid for saying this. I wish I had more of his music. He's got all these songs on the web for free. I'll go download some. I haven't played his music in a long time, but one of our regular correspondents sent me an email and just said, hey, I ran into David at, I think in Montana a couple of nights ago. And matter of fact, it was Kate who sent me an email. I forget where she was at, but Kate in the desert. I forget where she was at, but she said, yeah, David Rovick, and we were chatting. He said, yeah, he knows, he knew you. And it just started me thinking, damn, why haven't I been talking about David Rovick? Because his music is worth listening to. So there you go. Like I said, I got two pieces of good news tonight. That's the first part. The second part will come later in the program. Go to his website. Or not. It's up to you. I mean, I'm not, you know. David Rovick, R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovick.com. A lot of you already know him. A lot of you are going, yeah, Malloy, Jesus Christ, I've been listening to him for years. Okay. But a lot of people don't know him. And you folks listening on Sirius and XM, traveling around the country, you know, out and about, you should get some of his, get his music, download it. He's got it out there free. I mean, this is not a plug to buy his CDs. You can go get his stuff free. It's there. He says, take it. Or whatever. Check it out, will you please? DavidRovics.com. David, R-O-V-I-C-S. DavidRovics.com. And he doesn't sound anything like Bob Zimmerman. I'm just saying that there, it's in the lyrical quality of his songs. The lyrics, just, I don't know, man. There's a Kerouacian, kind of Ken Kesey, kind of Bob Zimmerman kind of thing happening there. Okay. All right. Thanks. Appreciate it. Okay. All right. It is, all over the news, getting 2 minutes on ABC and 2.5 on NBC, and I don't know, a little bit more on CNN, a little bit more on MSNBC. But it's not going to get a whole lot of coverage, I don't think, maybe not. But the Census Bureau has released some figures from 2009. And the news is real scary. It's real scary. We're going to get to that when we come back from the break. And also, I give up. I give up. I tried to resist calling a moment with Bob, a moment with Bob. A lot of my emailers have been writing to me. A lot of people have been writing saying, why did you take away a moment with Bob? And I keep saying, I didn't. Bob decided, he just, you know, he was out of things to say. Well, guess what? We've decided to come back with moments from Bob in kind of a different way, even darker than what it used to be, with a different theme song. So, due to a popular demand, he's back. So, what happened? Oh, I don't know. I was looking at the clock wrong. So, A Moment with Bob is back, and we're going to play that in about, well, right at the bottom of this hour. So, stick around. So, there you go. What more could you want? You got David Rovick, you got Bob Alexander, and you got poverty in America that's going off the charts. We are in high cotton, folks. Did all that for 2 hours till they realized they're economic disease.
Factor, only with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Oh, and I have a message for you from Ask Me, American Federation of State County Municipal Employees. We know all too well what happens when Republicans run the show. We get apologies and favors for big oil and Wall Street, schemes to privatize Social Security, and hundreds of thousands more layoffs for just about everybody, but including teachers, nurses, and firefighters. As we get close to November, remember, history only repeats itself if you let it. Poverty rate. The percentage of Americans struggling below the poverty line in 2009 was the highest it's been in 15 years. Census Bureau released this report today, and interviews with poverty experts and AIDS groups say the increase appears to be continuing this year. According to the report, 4 million additional Americans found themselves in poverty in 2009. 4 million additional Americans, which pushed the total to 44 million people living in poverty. One in seven in the United States. Millions more are getting by only because of a mix of expanded unemployment that the Republicans want to end forever, and other assistance that the Republicans want to end forever, and in a growing number of cases because families are doubling up. Kids are moving in with aging parents. When I say kids, I don't mean teenagers, although they are less inclined to leave home because there's no place to go. I'm talking about 30 and 40-somethings with their own children. And the numbers, as cold and calculating as the numbers are, could have been higher. One way embattled Americans have gotten by is by sharing homes with their siblings or parents or even non-relatives, sometimes resulting in sleeping on couches, living in a basement, staying in an attic, whatever. But it holds down the rise in the national poverty rate. This is the invisible poor, right? The share of people in this country in poverty climbed 14% in 2009, the highest level recorded since 1994. The rise was steepest for children. One in five children in this country now lives in poverty. Now, if that doesn't make you say, son of a bitch, I don't know what would. One in five, 20% of our kids. The report provides the most detailed picture yet of the impact of what has happened to the economy of this country. It shows the impact of the recession and unemployment on incomes, especially at the bottom of the scale. It also, the one little bright spot, indicates that the temporary increase in aid provided in last year's stimulus bill eased the burdens on millions of families. But that's all over. For a single adult in 2009, the poverty line was $10,830 annually in pre-tax cash income. For a family of four, $22,050. Think about that. $22,050. $400 a week. Right? $22,050 for a family of four for a year. That's considered the poverty level. What about people who are making $25,000 a year, a family of four? They don't show up in these numbers, do they? How about $26,000? How about $23,000? If the poverty line is $22,050 for a family of four, what about $22,060? How about $22,055? Those people don't show up in the poverty increase. So what does that mean? It means the numbers, in that sense, are nonsense. If these numbers indicate that 20% of children in this country live in poverty, then the real number is probably more like 27%, 28%. Now we're getting close to a third. Are 29%, 30%. Hey, this is the United States, by God, America. We got more billionaires here than any place except, India, I guess. What's going on? What's going on? Given the depth of this depression that we're in, some economists had expected an even larger jump in the number of poor. Timothy Smeeding, director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin, says, quote, "A lot of people would have been worse off if they didn't have someone to move in with. So the numbers, as bad as they are in fact much worse." More on this when we come back. I told you.
I'm just taking vacations by the mountains or the sea. Don't sell that old cow for a car. You might want to stay right where you are. Take a little advice from me. 'Cause I read the want ads every day. The voices in the paper always say, if you ain't got the dough, right, me. Boy, if you ain't got the dough, right, me. You better go back to your beautiful Texas.
C-SPAN, so you don't have to. It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. We're talking about the Census Bureau report issued today about poverty in the United States and how many of us are now listed as people living in poverty. The numbers are just astonishing. This is the United States of America, right? Huh? I mean, this is American Empire. We have the military in, 80 countries? We're fighting two wars, right? For a single adult in 2009, the poverty line was $10,830. For a family of four, $22,050. Timothy Smeeding, director of the Institute for Research on Poverty, University of Wisconsin, said, quote, "A lot of people would have been worse off if they didn't have someone to move in with," end quote. Mr. Smeeding said that in a typical case, a struggling family like a mother and children who would be in poverty on their own stay with more prosperous parents or other relatives so they don't show up in the poverty rolls or poverty numbers. A Census Bureau study found an 11.6% increase in the number of such multifamily households over the last 2 years. Included in that number was one James Davis, 22 years old, Chicago, lost a job as a package handler for FedEx in February 2009. As he ran out of money, he and his two-year-old daughter moved in with his mother about a year ago, avoiding destitution while he searched for work. "I couldn't afford rent," he said. Denise Sanders, 31, her three children have been sleeping in the living room of her mother and sister's one-bedroom apartment in San Pablo, California, for the last month. No end in sight. They doubled up after the bank foreclosed on her landlord. Not her, on her landlord, forcing her to move. "It's getting harder," said Ms. Sanders, who makes a low income as a mail clerk. "We're all pitching in for rent and bills." The numbers continue to rise. And again, it's just how much more of this can we take? Dr. Smeeding, from the University of Wisconsin, said it seemed almost certain that poverty would further rise this year. He noted, according to the New York Times, that the increase in unemployment and poverty had been concentrated among young adults without college educations and their children, and that these people remained at the end of the line in their search for work. Young adults without college educations. If you're over a certain age, you remember, get out of high school, go to work in manufacturing, and put your kids through college. You remember that. If you're over a certain age, you remember how that was done. One indirect sign of this ongoing hardship is the continuing rise in food stamp recipients. Food stamps, what the right wing wants to get rid of. Food stamp recipients now include nearly one in seven adults. One in seven, and an even greater number, an even greater share of the nation's children. While other factors, as well as declining incomes, have driven this rise in food stamp recipients, by mid-2010, the number of recipients had reached 41.3 million, compared to 39 million at the beginning of the year. Think about these numbers. Think about them. Charity food banks report incredible demand rising. It's not letting up. Maria Goodwin, director of Jeremiah's Food Pantry in East St. Louis, Illinois, said, quote, we're seeing more younger people coming in. People that not only don't have any food, but they have no place to live. The pantry was open one day a month when it opened in 2008. This year it's open 5 days a month. A month. That's all the food they can get their hands on. Texas Food Bank said they had distributed 14% more food in the second quarter of 2010 than in the same period last year. All right, now let's break it down. Census reports showed increases in poverty for whites, blacks, Hispanic Americans, with historic disparities continuing, as they do. We live in a racist society. The poverty rate for non-Hispanic whites, that would be me, 9.4%. For blacks, 25.8%. For Hispanics, 25.3%. For Asians, 12.5%. The decline in incomes in 2008 had been greater than expected. And when the two recession years are considered together, 2008, 2009, the fall in income is 4.2%. So that's according to Lawrence Katz, an economist at Harvard. Gains achieved earlier in the decade were wiped out. And a median family income in 2009 were 5% lower than in 1999. Mr. Katz said, quote, now listen up, this is the first time in memory that an entire decade has produced essentially no economic growth for the typical American household, end quote. An entire decade. Who is in control of that decade? Whose policies are still reverberating and ricocheting around the society, huh? Go ahead and say it. God damn it, say it. George W. Bush. They killed the country. That's why Bush, as much of a jerk and a moron as he was, that's why he was put in office. Let Cheney handle him, and let Bush be the president. For the first time in memory, Mr. Katz says, I don't know what that means, first time in memory, an entire decade has produced essentially no economic growth for the typical American household. Nothing. Oh, the number of U.S. residents without health insurance climbed to 51 million in 2009 from 46 million in 2008. Now, those ranks are expected to shrink in coming years as the healthcare overhaul adopted by Congress in March begins to take effect. But don't count those chickens before they start to infect your family with E. coli, because I'll tell you why. When the Republicans get control, they are going to end Obamacare before it starts. Of course. Why wouldn't they? This is not good stuff. This is not good stuff at all. So what do we do about it? There was where is it, if I can find it, a conversation between, I can't find it. Well, Nader was, was it in something that Prairie 2 sent me a report I'm going to try to get to tonight, but one of the lines Prairie 2 has, it's a quote from the Gilded Age, back at the turn of the 19th century. American financier Jay Gould said, after hiring strikebreakers, you know, one of the big financiers, one of the big industrialists, like we have today, and people working in one of Jay Gould's many factories went out on strike, and this is before unions had too much strength, and Jay Gould said, I can hire one half of the working class to kill the other half. I can hire one half of the working class to kill the other half. You think that's not true? Oh, I know what it was. Ralph Nader and Chris Hedges. We're talking. Chris Hedges' new piece at Truth Dig. And they were talking about, you know, what to do. And as we've said on this program before, revolution always comes out of the middle class. Nader said, according to Chris Hedges, poor people do not organize. They never have. It has always been people who have fairly good jobs. You don't see Walmart workers massing anywhere. The people who are the most militant are the people who had the best blue-collar jobs. Their expectation level was high. When they felt their jobs were being jeopardized, they got really angry. But when you are at $7.25 an hour, you want to hang on to $7.25 an hour. It's a strange thing. He went on to say, Nader did, people have institutionalized oppressive power in the form of surrender. It's not that they like it, but what are you going to do about it? Now you make the best of it. The system of control in this country is staggeringly dictatorial. It breaks new ground and innovates in ways no one in human history has ever innovated. You start in American history where these corporations have influence. Then they have lobbyists. Then they run candidates. Then they put their appointments in top government positions. Now they're actually operating the government. Look at Halliburton and Blackwater. Yesterday, somebody in our office called the Office of Pipeline Safety. That proposed the San Bruno explosion in California. The press woman answered. The guy in our office saw on the screen that she had CTR next to her name. He said, what is CTR? She said, I'm a contractor. He said, this is the press office of the Department of Transportation? They contracted out the press office? Yes, she said. But that's okay. I come to work here every day. The corporate state is the ultimate maturation of American-type fascism. Truth Seeker, we are here. The question is not what are we going to do when we get here, but the question is what are we going to do now that we are here to get out. We'll be right back.
Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of rich man's and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach,
I should know to leave them home.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
Oh, yeah. Bob Alexander, when we come back after the top of the hour. I've got another website for you to go to, the American People's Lobby. The American People's Lobby.org. The American People's Lobby.org. Check that one out. The American People's Lobby.org. Email from David writes, Mike, I heard Hannity and the Pigman were telling voters to vote for O'Donnell in New Hampshire because Mike Castle voted yes to impeach George Bush. Of course, this is nonsense because there was no impeachment vote of George Bush. And for the teabaggers to believe this goes to show you just how dumb they are. and that they believe the president is a socialist Marxist Muslim born and raised in Kenya, sent to the U.S. by his father to screw all the white corporatist greedy bastards, and they all believe this blank. This is truly sad, and the number one reason the teabagger GOP fascist Nazis should never be back in power, and we should just watch them tear themselves apart and drive them into oblivion like the old Whig Party, David. Really? Did that happen? I don't doubt that the pig man told people that Mike Castle voted yes to impeach George Bush. That's something the pig man would say. Hannity, who would drink the pig man's vomit if given a chance, probably repeated what he heard Limbaugh say. Hannity nails himself to the pig man's program and has two or six of his secretaries take furious notes so that when it's Hannity's turn to come on and put out the neo-fascist propaganda, he can match what he says with what Limbaugh said earlier in the day. Voted to impeach George Bush. Terry in Livermore, California writes, Mike, as a liberal, I'm tired of being accused of being stupid for not supporting Obama, Gibbs, Biden, and the Democrats, especially when it comes to the 2010 election. Obama and the Democrats have done nothing to justify my voting for them. Number one, the health care bill is a joke. No single payer, no public option, no true controls on costly premiums, which forces my daughter to buy health care at the same corrupt insurance companies who have destroyed our medical system. Two, we still have two unfunded wars going on. Three, we are still violating individual rights. Isn't Gitmo still open, and aren't we still doing rendition? Four, nothing has been done to create jobs except to save 3 million public sector jobs, which will be gone next year because the funding provided by Obama was only for 1 year. Five, nothing has been done to help the homeowners. Finally, if Biden, Obama, and Obama continue to badmouth the liberals, I will not only not vote for a Democrat, but I just might vote for a Republican. I wouldn't do that if I were you, Terry. P.S. Here in California, the pension system for public sector workers is so underfunded. 50 to 75% of a city or county budget goes to paying for the salary and pension benefits of the police and firefighters retired. That leaves no money for the poor, the children, or the seniors. For example, if your son was a firefighter here, he would earn roughly $100,000 and not have to contribute to his pension, which he could take at age 50 with 90% of his last year's salary. Really? I didn't know. I know that a lot of states have public worker pension systems that are beyond belief, but I'll take Terry's word for it until somebody says, that's not true. Oh, and according to billionaire George Soros, and who would know but him, the record high surge in the price of gold is the ultimate bubble. Mr. Soros cautioned individuals who have been exhorted by television advertisements and radio commentators and doomsday predictions to pile into the precious commodity. He says, quote, I call gold the ultimate bubble. It may be going higher, but it's certainly not safe, and it's not going to keep going higher forever. Yeah, that's going to be the next, although I don't know. I don't know who buys gold. I know that Goldline has its own personal whore. No offense to sex workers. That is, you know, back. I wonder if when the price of gold collapses, if the people who are sucked into the Goldline story will show up at Fox Television in New York and drag Beck into the street and do things to him. You think? The Senate today approved a multi-billion-dollar package of tax breaks and government-backed loans for small businesses. Only two Republicans. The vote passed, 61 to 38. Two Republicans, George Voinovich of Ohio, who's retiring, and George Lemieux of Florida. Lemieux? Lemieux, Lemieux. It is French. Join the Democrats in voting in favor. Legislation now goes to the House, where leaders hope to quickly approve it. Senator Obama, in addition to providing tax breaks and enhancing a number of existing aid programs run by the Small Business Administration, the legislation will create a $30 billion lending program administered by the Treasury Department to channel government-backed loans through community banks. I don't know. Is that going to stimulate a recovery, jobs? I don't know. I don't know. All right, we'll be back after the break, and we will have some Bob Alexander, back by popular insistence, and some other stuff. All right? Don't forget, two websites that I want you to check out during the break. Will you do that? The first one is The American People's Lobby, theamericanpeopleslobby.org, and David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovics.com. Stick around. We'll be right back. Seven past the hour. This is the Molloy Program. Quick couple of emails here. One from Deb regarding public pensions we were just talking about. Deb writes, I really enjoyed listening to your show. You just read a message from someone in California. One of the complaints was about public pensions. I'm a recently retired teacher. We pay into a public pension instead of Social Security. Even if we have worked in the private sector, we get minimal Social Security, usually about $100 a month. I don't know of any system where the public employees do not contribute. In most cases, it is the same percent as Social Security. Thanks for the outrage, Deb. Yeah, well, I'm glad, someone else has written in about this. I don't know how a public pension system works anywhere. I mean, I understand the concept of a pension. You know, paying into it. There's your socialism for you, right? Everybody pays into it. The money is invested someplace. And the returns then come after people retire. But who's getting a fair amount and who is not? Whose pension makes sense and whose doesn't? I don't know. I really don't. From Michael and Roswell, speaking of the teabaggers and Christine O'Donnell. Is that her first name, Christine? Okay. She is definitely one of them, Michael writes, a kindred soul. The following is from O'Reilly's program, one of his programs, in 2007, when O'Reilly wanted to talk with a doctor about an experiment in Oregon that attempted to clone a monkey. And some bright scheduler thought having on O'Donnell to talk about the ethics of it would be a good idea. This is what O'Donnell said, quote, they are doing that here in the United States. Oregon? They are doing that here in the United States. American scientific companies are crossbreeding animals and humans and coming up with mice with fully functioning human brains. So they're already into this experiment. End quote. And Michael says it's like Sonny Bono and a Saturday Night Live church lady had a baby and tried to leave it on the steps of the Senate building. coming up with mice with fully functioning human brains. Jesus Christ. And she's the Republican Party Senate nominee from the great state of Delaware.
I read Stuart Little, the Molly. I know all about
You know all about little mice, yeah.
There was Mickey Mouse.
And the website I gave you, AmericanPeoplesLobby.org, that comes from Park. Dear Mike, I'm still mad about Biden saying progressives better get energized. Really? After the White House spent the last 2 years disenfranchising the left? I've spent the last 6 months trying to figure out where to return my Obama change hat. Then Biden comes on Rachel Maddow's program the other night, like some guy's mom apologizing to his girlfriend because he cheated. We need to take this back ourselves. Park. It's the American People's Lobby. TheAmericanPeople'sLobby.org. Am I giving you too many websites? It's only two. You can handle it. Okay, let's see if I can get this in. This is from Prairie 2, our economics affairs correspondent. A multifamily tent down by the river. Initial jobless claims didn't go up last week, but are still well above a number that would point toward the recovery or of the 8 million jobs lost, or really 12 million jobs lost, if you provide for the 100,000 young adults that reach working age each month. The consistently high claims numbers also reflect a deliberate churn in the corporate workforce designed to drive down wages as more and more workers are fired, replaced with temps, part-time workers, or are themselves converted to some type of contract labor that doesn't count as an employee, but rather as just a disposable commodity. The steady conversion of Americans to neo-feudal serfs is demonstrated in the burgeoning poverty rate, with 1 in 7 now below the official poverty line. This was a 10% jump over the previous year, and this change was, in fact, not as bad as expected by economists. Extended unemployment kept the increase in the number of Americans newly falling into poverty to about half of what it would have been. The census numbers aren't really current numbers, as hundreds of thousands of people each month are running out of benefits. The total number of Americans in poverty is the largest since they started to count the poor 50 years ago. Let me digress for just a second. Who was it I saw on a clip from television today? Some Republican senator, I think, who said that the poverty level right now is the same as it was when Lyndon Johnson began the war on poverty, and there's your proof that the poverty programs don't work. I mean, how many ways do you want to attack that statement? Let me go back to what Prairie 2 wrote. Another disturbing trend the Census Bureau identified is that many families are doubling up to count as a single household. Moving three generations in together or even with friends keeps them all above the poverty level, but that's hardly the American dream. These multifamily households have increased by 12% over the previous year alone. Some of these so-called units are living in single tents in homeless encampments. The poverty line is artificially set at about 22 grand for a family of four, but this number is really an inadequate marker. In fact, a family really needs three times that in most urban areas to live anything like the American dream. Fully two-thirds of Americans are now below that American dream level, and most are falling steadily behind. Continuously increasing tuition and health care costs, impoverished parents and children with children to care for, all these things drag down middle-class families. It is becoming increasingly unlikely that anything more than a small percentage will ever rise to the American dream level. Americans like to think this is a land of opportunity, but it really has become the most stratified in the developed world, caused by the death of the unions, the end of small business, and a lack of any meaningful social safety net. When combined with the economic realities that allow no opportunity for those outside the corporate elite, and corporate serfdom enforced by the threat that you will become one of the millions of hopeless unemployed, the fact is that upward mobility is officially dead. Even a college education becomes nothing but a millstone of debt, consigning most graduates to wage slavery. Colleges have gone from cautioning freshmen about putting on weight to instructing them on how to apply for food stamps, with applications up 120% just this year. We are well into a new Gilded Age, without the equivalent to industrial revolution of the 19th century, as we are becoming de-industrialized. During the last Gilded Age, American financier Jay Gould said, after hiring strikebreakers, "I can hire one half the working class to kill the other half." Today, this is reflected by the teabagger movement that is portrayed as populist, but is entirely funded by the likes of current Jay Goulds to further the interests of today's billionaires. To end on a bit of good news, there was another little spark of hope from the Obama administration, with the president bypassing the Senate and appointing Elizabeth Warren to form the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. In name, she's an assistant to the president and senior advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury Department. She might not technically have as much authority as if she were the Senate-confirmed director, but thanks to precedents set into common law by the Bush crime family, Ms. Warren could run her own death squad if the president so authorized. The big advantage this new agency has is that it comes with no embedded Republicans. And since Ms. Warren works directly for the president, she has no other boss in the bureaucracy and can staff the agency as she sees fit. Republicans and their Wall Street masters are livid, and that is good news indeed. Prairie2.com. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that a little bit later in the program tonight, probably next hour. Okay. Break. And in about 15 minutes, Bob Alexander. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
They follow me to the star with these toes I can't fold. Kids, take them back, you know. Better than that, does that talk as you know?
Nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Message from AFSCME. We all know too well what happens when Republicans run the show. Apologies and favors for big oil and Wall Street. Schemes to privatize Social Security and hundreds of thousands more layoffs for our teachers, nurses, and firefighters. As we get close to November, remember history repeats itself only if you let it. Next hour, some good news from the Obama administration. I've already mentioned it tonight, but we're going to expand on it. It is the direct result of pressure from consumer groups and unions. Yeah, it really happened. Also, a real heart-stopping report from the UK about our involvement in Afghanistan. I'm being a little sarcastic there. But you'll know what I mean when you hear it. And I think if we can get to it, how we're losing the hearts and minds of the Pakistanis, and why. Linda in Phoenix sends me an email that says, "Mike, I really hate to bother you with this nonsense, but I know you have to be mindful of language you use on the air, so I thought you would know if the word pee is considered offensive and could be bleeped, or you could be fined for using it. The reason I'm asking is I applied for a personal license plate here in Phoenix. I wanted the license plate to read, I need numeral 2, letter P. They sent me a letter 2 days later saying it was offensive, and they were turning it over to a review board. Whatever happened to freedom of speech and freedom of bodily functions? If they ask me to make another choice, I think I'll submit AZ sucks. Lyndon Phoenix. All right. Who let Lyndon near the wine? This is from... I'm going to leave this person anonymous. The subject line is people without a job moving in with other people. My emailer says, I think about this all the time. I don't have family to move in with yet. But my wife has a much younger sister in a good-sized home in Miramar, Florida. But she is into drugs. She inherited the house. And I see people living alone on the street every day, and many talk to themselves. I guess just to feel alive in some way. Then I think what little we have, and if we lost the bit of money we get, what we would fit into our old small car, and even if it would make it to Florida. Perhaps we would have to choose what is most vital for memory's sake, and then, of course, there is our three cats. Then I have to stop myself before I lose my entire mind and just hope things turn out, and at close to 62 and my wife close to 65, at times it all does not seem to matter for us too much any longer. And with all this horror, we call this America? Signed by, I'll leave anonymous. Yikes. And then we have the teabaggers. Yeah. All right. We're going to share with you, back by popular demand, A Moment with Bob. Although we do have some different music. I'm not going to use that ukulele. Was that ukulele? That was ukulele. We're going to use King Crimson. No, when we come back. Not right now. Oh, my God, we have a break here. And can you play some of that music? Let's hear some of that music. You don't have it? You don't have it up? Oh, I thought you were all ready to play it.
I can't like that.
Oh. Oh, okay. All right, we'll play it when we come back, and then we will do a moment. I don't even think we ought to call it A Moment with Bob. He writes, a guy calling himself Kilgore Trout, ha ha ha, dropped me a Facebook message recently demanding I write more moments and requested the music be played again. I wrote back saying that things look pretty bleak from my perspective, but I give it a try. If I could presume to ask for a music change, I've attached a small file that sounds more fitting to the subject matter I'll be writing about. If you don't care for it, I understand. Yeah, all right. The name of the title of Bob's essay when we come back is The Luxury of Time, or Nothing's Easy, Everything's Hard, or The Debate is Over. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Renegade Talk Radio done right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Okay. Are you ready? Go ahead, let her rip. Again, for a moment with Bob. Hey, Mike, how much more time are we going to waste trying to convince crazy, stupid people about the reality of global climate change? Or what the concept of peak oil really means? And if peak oil is too scary to contemplate, what about peak water? The state of peak water is being approached in many areas around the world. 1.8 billion people will be living with absolute water scarcity within 15 years, and two-thirds of the world population could be subject to, quote, water stress, end quote, when the demand for water exceeds the available supply. Let's perform a quick experiment. Starting tomorrow, let's all agree to use 50% less water in our homes than we use today. Sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? We'll conserve. That's the ticket. The average family of four uses about 400 gallons of water every day. Can we all agree that it makes sense to try to bring that figure down to 200 gallons a day? We'll fix all our leaky faucets and buy WaterSense labeled toilets. That could save about 5 gallons with every flush. And then we'll buy the new washer-efficient front-loading non-agitator washing machines. That would be water efficient. We can also save up to 10 gallons a day by washing our dishes more efficiently. And last but not least, turn off the tap when you're brushing your teeth or shaving. After buying new appliances and restructuring the way we use water around the house, a family of four could cut water usage down to 200 gallons per day. Good for us. We're well on the way to solving the looming water shortage. Now, factor in this. We only use 10% of the water for municipal supplies. Industry uses 20% of the water, and the remaining 70% is used to grow our food. But it takes thousands of times more water to make a cow than a bushel of grain. Now, I'm not saying we should all become vegetarians, but how many people could die of thirst because Americans eat over 38 million burgers every day? Now, factor in this. There are about 16,000 golf courses in the United States. Half the total in the entire world. Audubon International estimates the average American golf course uses 312,000 gallons of water a day. There are 57 golf courses in the desert city of Palm Springs, California. Each course soaks up 1 million gallons of water a day. That is, each course, each day, in Palm Springs, consumes as much water as a family of four uses in 4 years. And by the way, Golf Digest reported that 41% of golfers polled believe that global warming is a myth. I wonder what they'd think about peak water. Because we no longer have to debate about global climate change and peak oil, what are we going to do about it? We've all seen Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. We're all agreed we should shrink our personal carbon footprint. I've changed all our incandescent lights to compact fluorescent bulbs. We've weather-stripped doors and windows, turned down the thermostat, insulated walls, the attic, the pipes, and the water heater. We've limited driving as much as possible, and I take the bus everywhere. We only buy locally grown organic food and always follow the three R's. Reduce, reuse, recycle. And as much as I hate gardening, next year we'll be growing as much food as we can in our garden. A 55 mile per hour speed limit was imposed by Richard Nixon back in 1974. That lowered the nation's fuel consumption by 2%, or 167,000 barrels of oil per day. Ronald Reagan reversed all that in 1986, and speed limits were once again allowed to be set by individual states. Today, the United States could save 4% of its total oil consumption by again lowering the speed limit to 55 miles an hour. Our little family has already slowed down to 55. That's why everybody passes us. What if we all tried to do everything we could to postpone the day of reckoning peak oil and global climate change will bring? Would that be enough to make a difference? Well, factor in this. A U.S. Navy destroyer uses the same amount of oil in a week that a city of 200,000 people uses in a year. Regardless of what we do to shrink our footprint, the dominant culture, the empire, our civilization is still hell-bent on killing us all. How much more time can we waste trying to convince crazy, stupid people that capitalism is insane? The planet is finite. You can't inflate it and make it bigger. How much longer will we avoid confronting the scariest fact of all, which is our civilization is destroying the planet? Our culture is insane. Krishnamurti said, "It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society." And Derek Jensen wrote, "Within this culture, wealth is measured by one's ability to consume and destroy." The dominant culture has poisoned the air, land, water, and us. Dioxin is in every mother's breast milk. Civilization is stripping the land and oceans of life. 90% of the largest fish in our oceans are, well, gone. Where do we draw the line? When do we say enough? When do we make our stand? Do we wait until 95% of the fish are gone? 97% of the world's native forests have been cut. Do we wait until they are all gone? Where does it say civilization has the right to destroy the world? Do we protest wars? Wars are symptomatic of the insane culture. Bush and Cheney are symptomatic of the dominant culture. Greedy Republicans and cowering Democrats are symptomatic of the dominant culture. Our institutions protect the dominant culture. To quote Jensen again, "Surely by now there can be few here who still believe the purpose of government is to protect us from the destructive activities of corporations. At last, most of us must understand that the opposite is true, that the primary purpose of government is to protect those who run the economy from the outrage of the injured citizens." So how the hell do we stop this? Johnson says every morning when he wakes up, he asks himself if he should write or blow up a dam. He says, quote, "You and I can write all we want, but that doesn't help the salmon. What they need is for dams to be removed and logging stopped," end quote. We hope that our culture will undergo a voluntary transition. What if it doesn't? Do we write, protest, boycott, and then blow up dams? We may not have the luxury of time to discuss what we're going to do, but we are going to have to talk about it. What are we going to do? Regards, Bob. Yes. Now, before you write to me and say, "Where can I get a copy of that?" go to superbeans.com. Superbeans. Superbeans. Superbeans.com. Well, I told you this was going to be... I said I had two bits of good stuff at the beginning of the show, uplifting and happy. David Rovick's website. And next hour, a report on Elizabeth Warren. And plus a real heart stopper from the UK about our involvement in Afghanistan. Okay. Right? Stick around. What else we got? I got a lot of stuff here, but we have a break coming. And most of this, I found that most of the stuff that we want to talk about, just too involved. Regarding the Mott apple juice plant that the union forced to stop the nonsense. The plant was saying we're going to cut your wages because you guys are making $25 an hour and everybody else around here in upstate New York makes $14, $15, so we're going to cut your wages. This after this factory showed $500 million in profits. And the union said no, and they went out on strike, and now it's apple season all of a sudden, and the Mott organization decided to settle, and they did settle. And the workers, I think 300, 400 of them went back to work. Well, I have a little email here from Sand that I'll share with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, regarding what George Soros said about gold is the ultimate bubble, and it's happening now. Gold is up to what, $1,400 an ounce? Good God. It wasn't that long ago a bag of reefer cost more per ounce than an ounce of gold. I mean, it just wasn't that long ago. Anyway, Bruce writes, in the price of gold, of course it's a bubble. And guessing when it will pop is impossible, but it will. Hyperinflation could drive it much higher first, but at some point more people will want to sell than buy. And then, look out. If you want to win by timing the market, you should have bought it at $250 an ounce. It can give a certain peace of mind if you want some insurance against doomsday, but if things get that bad, you won't be able to buy anything useful with it until things start to recover. And plenty of people will be selling gold bars for something to eat. So I still recommend canned goods. Damn, I don't know why that always cracks me up, but it does. In the long run, good times will drive gold down, and bad times will drive gold down. In the short term, gold will go up until the cash runs out. Then people will start selling. Canned goods. Snapple. This is from Sand, who writes, Mike, the Snapple organization had to settle because our county's apples are ready for processing. As far as juice from China, when my kids were in school, I would back their lunches every day. I bought Juicy Juice because it was all juice, no sugar water, or HFCSs. Then I found out that most of their apple juice came from China. I had to switch to organic boxes of juice at twice the cost, or water, which they hated at the time. As another item here from Sand, at 2:45 a.m. Monday, gunshots went off in my yard, 6 pistol shots. I called 911 without turning on any lights, and it took the New York State Trooper 25 minutes to get here. In the meantime, more shots, a car driving back and forth without lights on. Turned out they were poaching deer in our orchard. They had three deer already stuffed into their Chevy Cobalt trunk. I was paranoid, I guess, that they were targeting me for being an outspoken anti-war activist and wanted to put fear in me in this teabag area. But nope, they probably had no food and no money. I wish they had gone further out in the boondocks to jack the deer, and I hadn't known about it. Sign of the times, I really believe so. Sand. Yeah, I can remember my mother telling me that during the Depression, you know, she and her family were okay because my grandfather was an Italian immigrant who, just before he came to this country, they used to eat tree bark, you know, weeds, because things were not very fruitful, shall we say, in Italy around the turn of the 20th century. But my mother used to tell me that while their family survived fine in Findlay, Ohio, they were well aware of other families in that small city or big town, whatever you want, about 35,000 people there at the time, other families who... And I used to ask my mother about this. No, come on. You're kidding me. No, she said, it was true. Families who had to eat the family pet in order to survive. That's what she told me. I hope that doesn't happen this time. Gosh, I hate to bail out of this hour without, all these things that, are staring me in the face, but, you know how it is on this program. We are like the road to hell. We start out with good intentions for the program every night about what we want to cover, and then, just don't have the time. Cynthia in San Jose writes, Mike, we're just reading an editorial about when are we going to stop destroying the planet? When 97% is gone? Actually, it was an essay from Bob. Well, the answer is we won't stop destroying it until 100% is gone. And then we are next, because I defy anyone to live without an environment. For those who think that we, you, me, your listeners, are lunatic tree huggers, well, I suggest they go live in outer space. Let's see how long they last if they think an environment is not important. Unfortunately, there are too many people who think they can do what they want without consequence, and so I'm pessimistic about our future. You know, when you look back at history, whenever man used up all the available resources, the population crashed, and I doubt the crash was ever very pretty. That is what is down the road for us. Yes, the Earth will recover. It has that ability given enough time. We just won't be here to see it. And that is my cheery thought for today. Ah, Cynthia in San Jose. All right. When we come back, some good news, and not just good news, but I have another thing to talk about that is, it's one of those stories where you go, duh, but you got to hear it. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. back indeed. Sorry for all my screaming outbursts and bad language. I'm always apologizing for that. As promised, some good news from the Obama administration, as reported this morning in the business press. Only the way it was reported was a little bit less than massively enthusiastic. How many people are familiar with the name Elizabeth Warren? Let me see some hands. Oh, good. Oh, I'll be damned. A lot of people. All right. Good enough. Then you know who she is. She was the person, for the two or three teabag freaks who listen to this program, she was the person who conceived of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Yeah, another one of those new communist government organizations, right? Right. She will oversee that new bureaucracy as an assistant to President Obama. That's according to an official who was briefed on the decision last night. Obama is going to announce it this week. He may have announced it today, and I just didn't hear it, but I think he's going to announce it this week. Probably tomorrow. They usually make these announcements on Friday. It'll allow Elizabeth Warren, a Harvard law professor, to effectively run the new agency without having to go through the confirmation battle in the Senate that the Republicans were hoping for. The Republicans wanted this woman nominated so they could gut her. And why do they want to gut her? Well, because she is pro-consumer, pro-worker, pro-middle class, pro-working class. And the Republicans will have none of that. The creation of this bureau is a centerpiece of Wall Street financial overhaul that Obama signed in July. And frankly, I think anything else that he signed probably will wind up being ineffective. Because no matter how carefully rules are written to try to rein in predatory capitalism, there are always ways to get around it. But if you have someone who is writing the rule book on the fly as she goes along, noticing how these criminal bastards on Wall Street continue to pillage and rape, if you have somebody writing the rule book as she goes along, it's a little more difficult to find the loopholes. Right, boys? Right. Now, Elizabeth Warren will be named an assistant to the president. And that prevents her from having to listen to slimy animals like Mitch McConnell or Jeff Sessions or the rest of these boys talking as, well, now, is it not a fact that your mama worked in an organization that would, you know, that kind of trash? She won't have to go through it. As an assistant to the president, she will be a senior White House staff member. That, like Rahm Emanuel. Ugh. She also will be a special advisor to Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, one of the most ineffective guys ever to operate in a position that he's in. By the way, Geithner never had anything to do with Goldman Sachs, so let's just keep that straight, all right? Timothy Geithner does not really come out of the financial industry. He just doesn't know what the hell he's doing, I don't think. Whatever. She'll be a special advisor to him and report jointly to Obama and to Geithner. Now, this is interesting because she's been very critical of Geithner. Very critical of some of his policies. So it'll be interesting. It'll be fun. I think it'll be fun to see what happens. The financial regulation law that was signed by Obama back in July delegated to the Treasury Department the powers of the Bureau, this Bureau, until a permanent director could be appointed and confirmed by the Senate to a 5-year term. Now, in normal times, you see, that would not be that difficult. Obama would enter her name as a nominee. It would go before Senate Banking Committee hearings, and then there would be discussions, and then she would be confirmed. But we don't live in those times. Those times exist only on black and white television. We're not there anymore. Now, this decision to name her a special assistant to the president does not preclude the possibility that Ms. Warren eventually will be the new bureau's director. And according to Sewell Chan, writing in the New York Times this morning, at the very least, she would play a pivotal role in deciding whom to appoint to the job if it's not her. She is 61. She's an authority on bankruptcy law. She has developed a following among liberals for her writings and advocacy on behalf of working class and middle class families. And that right there, you see, the Republicans would sink their goddamn fangs into a woman like this and try to tear her to pieces because her objective is advocacy on behalf of working class and middle class families. And the Republicans, the teabaggers, the capitalists want none of that. She has described the financial strains put on working class and middle class families in two books. The title of neither I have in front of me. One of them was written with her daughter. But here's no surprise to you whatsoever, truth seeker. She has drawn intense fire from financial institutions, you know, the big banks, the big hedge fund operators, the real scum suckers who continue to pillage this economy, who are billionaires, multimillionaires. They laugh at any kind of an effort to rein them in. They giggle and hoot and holler and take another $500,000 trip around the world anytime they hear somebody who says, well, we have to bring this craziness in Wall Street to an end. They laugh. They sit at the top of the food chain and tell the rest of us to go straight to hell. They laugh. So, these big institutions don't like Elizabeth Warren. Why? Because, according to the New York Times, because of her persistent attacks on children? No. Families? No. Religious people? No. Her persistent attacks on the handicapped? No. Old people? No. Puppies? No. Baby seals? No! She has drawn fire from financial institutions for her persistent attacks on abusive, deceptive, and unfair lending practices. See? What? What do you mean you're going to put somebody in there who doesn't like the fact that we are abusive, deceptive, and have unfair lending practices? What are you talking about? Get her out of there. Don't you dare put her in there. We want to continue our abuse. We want to continue our deception. We want to continue our unfair lending practices. For Christ's sake, this is America. I'm a capitalist. Some banking executives also believe that she has been overly broad in criticizing those practices, abuse, deception, unfair lending practices, driving working and middle class families into the dirt. The financial services industry, in all of its many hydra-headed shapes and forms and blood-sucking, monstrous attacks on the American public, don't like Elizabeth Warren. They don't like her. Consequently, she never, ever would have been appointed or would have been confirmed by the Senate. So good move, Mr. President. Good move. Appoint her as a special assistant to you and let the right wingers in Congress go chew on their own feet. We'll be right back. Spell the name of.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century.
It is 21 past the hour. All right, Elizabeth Warren, whose idea is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that will make an attempt once again to oversee the more vicious aspects of predatory capitalism that has more or less taken over the economic lifeblood of this country, what's left of it. Elizabeth Warren will be writing the rules about what these bastards can and cannot do. The financial services industry, all the institutions, the bankers, the hedge fund operators, the liars, the cheats, the sneaks, they don't want her anywhere near the multi-billion, trillion-dollar con scam they have going because she is persistent in her attacks on abusive, deceptive, and unfair lending practices. And that's just not fair! Nobody should say anything about that, damn you, Elizabeth Warren! Capitalism rules, baby! Our kind of capitalism, right, boys? Right, right, yeah, oh, we agree, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay. Labor unions and consumer advocacy groups said that Ms. Warren is particularly suited for this nasty, filthy job. This job is going to be like cleaning out latrines. It's going to be like draining septic tanks. Because that's what the financial services and the banking industry has become, a huge, stinking septic tank. That's going to be her job. Labor unions, consumer advocacy groups say she's particularly suited for the job she helped to create. And unions and consumer groups have been lobbying the White House for months to make the appointment official. Some even called on Obama to formally nominate her to lead the bureau, even if it did lead to a significant confirmation battle in the Senate. The theory being the Democrats should embrace such a battle as a means of drawing attention to the bureau's significance, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So writes Sewell Chan in the New York Times. I disagree completely. How would the American public ever get a chance to understand what the duties of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau really are and what role Elizabeth Warren would play? They can have hearings until hell freezes over. How will that be translated to the American public? Oh, please. Are you kidding? Within hours after her official nomination, Beck and Limbaugh and the rest of the pigs would have everybody believing Elizabeth Warren was born in Kenya and was not a citizen and had no business being there. Right? You know how this works. Come on. So while Sewell Chan writes that some consumer groups and labor unions wanted a public battle to get her confirmed, I completely disagree. To hell with that. To hell with that. If there's a way to get these people into positions to clean out the septic tank, other than having her walk through the kind of trash and filth that Sotomayor had to walk through. That, what's her name? The other one that was just confirmed, the other Supreme Court Justice, Kagan, that all these people had to walk through. If there's a way to avoid that, then by God, Barack Obama ought to do it. Cheney dead. Bush dead. Reagan dead. Clinton dead. Herbert Walker dead. But watch the right wing go nuts, because this bureau will consolidate employees and responsibilities from a host of other regulatory bodies, including the Federal Reserve, Federal Trade Commission, FDIC, and even the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They're all going to come together. But this bureau is expected to have hundreds of employees and a budget of up to $500 million. Oh, can you not hear it now? Can you not hear it now? The teabaggers. Oh, he's taking over the financial industry. Oh, he's taking over the lending industry. Oh, he's taking over this. Oh, he's a communist. Oh, he's a socialist. And what will Elizabeth Warren actually be doing? Trying to make sure that after repeated assaults on all of us by the financial industry, that maybe, just maybe, henceforth and here on, we will have some weapons to fight back against these son of a bitches, short of going to the streets fully armed. So good on you, Elizabeth Warren, and thank God. Well, okay, I'm sorry. Thank dog or something that Barack Obama listened to the people who have been telling him, appoint this woman. So maybe, just maybe, like I said, a little good news from the Obama administration, huh? But watch what's going to happen. Watch what's going to happen now. When word gets out, when the president does finally appoint her as a special assistant to the president that requires nothing, no confirmation, watch how the right-wing pigs, which is 99% of everybody on radio and television, watch how they go after her. Watch, listen, pay attention, and keep in mind what Elizabeth Warren is being appointed to actually do.
He's the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
Welcome back, 25 before the hour. Okay, now you have to sit down for this one. Oh, my. A bombshell. No pun intended. Sheila sent this to me and she said, others have known about this for centuries. And it's suddenly a bombshell? Here's the story from Eric Margolis, writing from the UK. There's an organization that you and I have never heard of. Well, a couple of you might have. I wouldn't be surprised if Prairie 2 hasn't heard of this, or Michael, or Irish Dave, but I've never heard of it. Have you? It's called the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS. And apparently, this London-based institute is the world's leading think tank for military affairs. This is like numero uno. IISS, International Institute for Strategic Studies. It represents and has among its associates the top echelon globally of defense experts, retired officers, senior military men, spanning the globe from the United States and Britain to China, Russia, and India. All kinds of people. Eric Margolis has been an ISS member, IISS member for 20 years. As he writes, the reports are always authoritative, but usually cautious and diplomatic. Sometimes they're even dull. You know, the business of global war and destruction and military affairs can be presented in a very dull bureaucratic way, right, truth seekers? Huh? For example, the term collateral damage. Who would think that that represents three-year-olds being blown into pieces of meat? See how dull it can be? Collateral damage. Anyway, 2 weeks ago, the IISS issued a report. Eric Margolis calls it explosive, on Afghanistan, that apparently is shaking Washington and its NATO allies down to their very warmongering hearts. The report, presided over while it was being written by the former deputy director of Britain's former intelligence agency, MI6. The report says the threat from Al-Qaeda and Taliban has been, are you ready? Sit down. Exaggerated by the Western powers. The report says the U.S.-led mission in Afghanistan has, ballooned out of all proportion. from its original aim of disrupting and defeating al-Qaeda. The U.S.-led war in Afghanistan, says IISS, using uncharacteristically blunt language, is, you ready, a long, drawn-out disaster. Oh. Well, golly, really? Now, if you've been paying attention, and who among us really does anymore, but recently CIA Chief Leon Panetta admitted there were no more than, sit down, 50 members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Yet President Barack Obama has tripled the number of U.S. soldiers there to 120,000 to fight 50 members of al-Qaeda? What? The IISS report goes on to acknowledge that the presence of Western troops in Afghanistan, sit down, you ready? Okay. Is actually fueling national resistance. No, really? You mean like Vietnam, Algeria, Honduras? Or no, forget them. My mistake. Chile? No, forget that too. You get the point, though. Fueling national resistance. I'll be damned. Eric Margolis says, I saw the same phenomenon during the 1980s Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. So did the rest of the world, Eric. Those of us who were paying attention, which apparently is nobody in positions of power and decision-making in the United States government, or the British government, for that matter, even though the British have had their asses handed to them twice over the centuries in Afghanistan. Rudyard Kipling wrote about it. But I digress. Interestingly, the portion of the report overseen by the former MI6 Secret Intelligence Service deputy chief, his name is Nigel Inkster. Is that a British name or not? Nigel Inkster. He finds little al-Qaeda threat elsewhere, like Somalia and Yemen, even though the Obama administration and the war makers in the U.S. military establishment together have been beefing up the attacks on both Somalia and Yemen. We are hitting them now with drones as well as so-called special ops, you know. Abandoning its usual discretion, Eric Margolis writes, the International Institute for Strategic Studies said it was issuing these warnings because the deepening war in Afghanistan was threatening the West's security interests. By distracting its leaders from the world financial crisis and Iran. And because we are burning through scarce funds needed elsewhere, i.e. the Western powers led by the United States. Powers? The Western countries led by the United States that insist on continuing this are bankrupting themselves. Now, as you can guess, the IISS's findings are a direct challenge to Barack Obama and Britain's new prime minister, the conservative David Cameron, and other U.S. allies with troops in Afghanistan. The report undermines the rationale used to sustain this increasingly unpopular conflict. It will certainly convince skeptics that the real reason for occupation of Afghanistan, Eric writes, has to do with, sit down, oil! Or, oh no, another one, excluding China from the region, or, ooh, keeping watch on nuclear-armed Pakistan. No, Eric, you're kidding! Really? And Eric is a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Well, by God, Eric, no snottiness intended here, but I am so glad that you folks have put into comprehensive sentences and paragraphs and chapters and subheads, and I'll bet I can download the whole thing in a PDF file, right? The obvious truth that, oh, I don't know, 1,500 years of history has laid out for anyone who wants to see it. You cannot defeat the tribes of Afghanistan. I don't care if your name is Alexander or Leonid or Jimmy or Barack or George or Attila or Genghis or Cheney. I repeat myself with those last ones, I understand. It cannot be done. So, why are we there? Oil? No, 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 no. Never oil. Never oil. Never natural resources. Never pipelines. Never, 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 never. And never trying to exclude China from the region. Never, 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 never. And never keeping watch on nuclear-armed Pakistan. No, 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 no. That's not why we're there. We're there to defeat the Taliban. We're there to defeat Al-Qaeda. All 50 of them. By God, we'll get them somehow, some way. We'll track down these 50 boogers. What do we got over there? 130,000, 120,000. That's not enough. We need 50,000. We need 500,000. We need a ratio of 10,000 to 1. Or no, I guess that would be 1,000 to 1. The report also goes on to propose an exit strategy from the Afghan war. Western occupation troops, IISS proposes, should be sharply reduced and confined to Kabul and northern Afghanistan, which is mostly ethnic Tajik and Uzbek people. Southern Afghanistan, Taliban country, should be vacated by Western forces and left alone. Taliban would be allowed to govern its own half of the nation until some sort of loose, decentralized federal system can be implemented. This was, in fact, pretty much the way Afghanistan operated before the Soviets decided to commit suicide in 1979. And the Soviets did commit the suicide, as far as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was concerned. You notice, if you open a book or a newspaper, they don't exist anymore! For that matter, neither does Genghis Khan or Alexander the Great nor the British Empire. Can nobody in the Obama administration take a hint here? The International Institute for Strategic Studies has this bombshell that was published yesterday in the Toronto Sun. Interestingly, it did not hit the front pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or even page 1412. It's just nowhere to be found. So to kind of wrap up Margolis's bombshell from London. The war in Afghanistan is turning against the increasingly wobbly Western occupation forces, Margolis writes. The U.S. installed Afghan leader Hamid Karzai openly prepares for direct peace talks with the Taliban and its allies in spite of opposition from the U.S., Britain, and Canada. Well, that's easy for the U.S., Britain, and Canada to say. They don't live there. But Hamid Karzai is like any other tin horn, punk-ass dictator that we have ever installed anywhere. I don't care if it was Ferdinand Marcos or Noriega or, I mean, you could go down the list. Jesus. Nguyen Cao Ky. How many do you want? The list of leaders. The Shah of Iran. The list of leaders that we have installed over the past 60 years, since the end of World War II, in countries where we wanted someone to hold the door open for us as we came stomping in to take anything that wasn't nailed down and to pry up the things that were nailed down. All of those people eventually become, I don't want to say useless, but they become, how do I put this? It becomes necessary to terminate them with extreme prejudice. Let's put it that way. Because they get in the way! It's one thing to have Hamid Karzai open the door for us in Afghanistan and bless our presence there as we try to pillage that country's natural resources, contain China, and yada, yada, yada. It's something else again when Hamid Karzai says, well, you know what? With all this pillaging going on, I think my brother and I will help ourselves to some. I mean, after all, this Afghanistan, we're the world's number one producer of opium poppies. I can't let all the drug dealers here and there make a fortune. Well, I don't get a cut. And all this aid money coming in, oh my God, billions. So Hamid Karzai and his family and his village and his tribe or whatever the hell it is, I think with him it's just his family. Remember, Hamid Karzai worked for a considerable period of time in the United States as a lobbyist for Unocal Oil. Really? Yeah, you knew that. Come on, don't be stupid. You knew that. So Hamid Karzai, who is now negotiating with the Taliban, why is that? Because Hamid Karzai and the Taliban speak the same language. Pashtun, I think. Is that what they speak? Pashtun? They speak the same language. How many Americans in Afghanistan, I mean Americans, you know what I mean, either one's carrying weapons or one's in the diplomatic corps, how many of them speak Pashtun? Right. So Hamid Karzai, our puppet boy, the guy with the well-tailored outfits, manicured fingernails, neatly trimmed hair, no big bushy beard for him. Oh, hell no. No. You can't go to the discos in London with bushy beards. Oh, no. Hamid Karzai is negotiating because he will be there after the United States retreats into its little enclaves like green zones and red zones and purple zones, and the drilling begins and the mining companies are set up. Hamid Karzai will have to deal with the people on a daily basis. So, hell yeah, he's going to make a deal. With whom? With the United States. He already has a deal with us. He is Afghanistan's Manuel Noriega. He knows what his deal is with the United States. Just be the front man. But watch your ass, Mr. Karzai. Watch your ass and other parts of your anatomy, because when we get tired of you, that's a blade slicing through your neck. So Hamid Karzai knows that. He's no fool. He's like the con artists that work the street in New York, the street being Wall. He knows. So he makes his deal with the Taliban. And he makes it very clear. Listen, I got to play along with these clowns, these pale faces. I have to play along with this. But you know, I'm making a lot of bread here. I'm putting a lot aside for my retirement, however short life that may be. But you know, I'm putting the money aside. And you know what, tribal leaders, I may even give you some. Okay, if you want to make your women dress up in burqas and your children remain illiterate as you have for the past 3,000 years, okay by me, palsies. I couldn't care less. Just do me a favor. Don't assassinate me, okay? All right? Don't kill me. I'll make sure that NATO, N-A-T-O, goes away eventually. So the International Institute for Strategic Studies says in a lengthy report that the United States and its Western puppets are making a hideous, horrible, horrendous, ongoing, in perpetuity mistake by continuing to try to do what Alexander the Great did prior to the birth of Jesus. We just won't learn, will we? Maybe someday. All right, True Seekers, thanks for hanging out tonight. I certainly appreciate your company. I really do. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Wake up 8.